Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Catherine J. Parkin. She teaches history at Monmouth University, and we're talking about her book, Food is Love: Advertising and Gender Roles in Modern America. Catherine, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, especially about this book.
Thank you, Mark.
How did you start down this road where you sort of looked at popular culture in different ways? In the last book we talked about, we looked at advertisements to start with. In this one, we're looking at food advertisements. How did you start down that?
I was really interested in the idea of women's work and the idea that women were being told that they were responsible for all the cooking, you know, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, and pretty much three meals a day. And the idea that that responsibility fell to women, but I knew from my own life experience and looking at history that men had, of course, been involved in shopping and cooking and so on. And women were increasingly working outside the home across the 20th century. So I got interested in how advertisers played a role in convincing the society that food is love, that they had to, that women had to use food to show their love and commitment to their families. And it seemed to me this was an area that we had never really looked at. Advertising is such a powerful business in our society, and yet the ads are almost invisible to us because they're so pervasive and they reinforce ideas about gender that are already kind of in place in the culture.
I want to mention you just didn't look at ads in magazines. You looked at things like the archives of the J. Walter Thompson Company, writings of people like John B. Watson, Ernest Dichter,
yes.
and the Institute for Motivational Research. Talk about that, because these are sort of the brain people behind the ads. These are the people that are telling the people who do the ads, this is what you need to do.
Yes, there are certainly advertisers who kind of make up their own ideas and create ads for their products. But in general, across the 20th century, particularly by the mid-century, they're using psychologists, they're using psychiatrists, they're using a lot of quote-unquote science to understand their consumers. And they're doing a lot of research, and you don't have to respect the research to understand that they're doing it. Dichter, for example, would interview women about their relationship to the foods that they were buying and conclude completely different things than the women themselves had said in these interviews. But he was selling ideas. He was selling messages to the advertising companies, and they're spending a lot of money. He's an incredibly successful psychologist bringing these ideas to these companies, persuading them that they should sell Rice Krispies as a bubbly female cereal. The women just said they liked it and it was airy. You know, they didn't say that it was female to them. But he's trying to gender foods. He's trying to sell them in a way that taps into not just the gender identities of the foods, but also tapping into the ideas of the consumers about what kinds of foods are appropriate for women and men to eat and to serve. They're really trying to rationalize how people consumed, not just buying the food, but also eating the food.
Your research in this book covers advertisements, mostly magazine advertisements, throughout the 20th century and then into this century too. And it's incredible. You were talking about the sexualization of food. I mean, there was a paper called The Sex of Rice. And the stuff I learned in your book is amazing to me. Came out in 1955. It was they determined that all foods have a gender, and therefore you can use that to sell the product. I read these things that you write, and I go, come on. And then sure enough, there's an entire series of ads of rice, selling rice sexually from that time period. I was aghast. Yet I remember seeing these ads as a kid in the magazines. I remember seeing them. And that's the insidious thing about these things, is that they sort of seep in and become the norm.
Yes, they try to capture you where you know, the ones you're referring to from the Rice Council of America would say, you know, no man wants the same thing every night, you know, spice it up with rice. You know, that they're trying to use these innuendos. And the fact that you might laugh at them or you might think they were clever allows them to enter into the idea that here they are in the 1970s or late 1960s in the midst of the sexual revolution, in the midst of the women's movement, and they're still trying to get women to use their sexual freedom and their independence to catch a man. You know, that it still goes back to this idea that their priority should be to figure out how to be a successful cook, you know, the ability to provide meals, and to please men. And the priority of men liking the food is always the focus of the ads. That's you right. never see, for example, women eating. You never
no, they're always
them.
Presenting the food to the guy and the rest of the family sitting
exactly.
at the table.
Exactly. It's and you still see that, you know, even with a frozen dinner from Stouffer's, you know, the woman is the one bringing it to the table. And he might have, you know, set the table or he might have done something else even in the modern day. But in general, the expectation of women doing the work is the thing that they're advertising. And they know that men are cooking and they know that they're bringing meals to the table, but they don't show it. They're definitely asserting historically and into the present a gender ideology with women using the food itself and also, as you referenced, the sexual innuendo, the kind of pleasure of the food being something that women are also supposed to spice up.
Well, that's because they were supposed to hold on to their man with food.
Yes.
And as the title of your book says, I mean, food is love. I mean, it's the both the love of the family, and that's all, you know, you're supposed to do that for your kids, but you're also supposed to hold to your man by giving them better rice. It sounds crazy that we're talking about it, but that's what the ads were about.
There's a tremendous one in the, I believe, in the 60s where it's for frozen food. And Dichter writes a lot about this. Companies are coming to him. How can we make our foods more appealing? It's coming out of a freezer. There's nothing about that.
Well, I want to stop you right there because there was some controversy about frozen foods. And you bring this up in the book because it was minimal preparation, yet they still wanted to give the person the illusion that they were preparing something.
Absolutely. And the threat that they used to sell that their foods were the best and would keep the man was that they should serve theirs, that Schraff's was the one that would not make your husband leave you. I mean, they're very threatening in some of the ads, but the risk is real, not just pleasing them, but not losing them.
It's amazing reading the language and how women are talked about in some of this stuff. Women were regarded primarily as consumers, as you write. But there's a title of one of your sections, Vats of Frothy Pink Irrationality.
Yes. The idea that the advertisers are just responding to the consumer or just trying to sell them, it's really not true. The evidence in the archives of these companies and of these researchers is that they're really quite disdainful of the consumer, and that dates back to Watson and others in the 1920s and arguably goes to the present in terms of thinking that women in particular can't make up their minds, that they just can't wait to clip coupons and fill out, you know, little promotional books and things like that, that they have all these kinds of beliefs about women that they keep hoping will lead them to become loyal or to be loyal consumers. And when you look at their evidence about men, they'll say, well, we can't advertise to men because we don't know what they're going to do. We can't predict if we advertise. But that's the height of an irrational consumer to them. But they never say that as a characteristic of male consumers. They just don't advertise to them, even as their research shows that between 25% and 40% of the consumers of food products are men.
And most of the advertisement, and just to reiterate this, was therefore geared towards women. So, but there were a few examples. You gave one in your book, but they had Joey Ross, you know, making a homemade pizza, and it was sort of like a goof because it's a guy trying to cook, you know, and you have this sort of broad comedian like making this homemade pizza, and it comes out okay in the end, and that's amazing because he's a guy and he shouldn't be able to cook. I mean, that's the message that that sent.
Yes, they are really insulting to men too. I don't.
Yeah, but in a completely different level, Catherine.
In a completely different way, yes. I mean, that Chef Boyardee pizza in a box is really, you know, characteristic. What they generally said was that men had, I would say, three things they could cook. One was to do the barbecue. The second was to toss the salad. And the third was to make pancakes on the weekend. And those are really the only three
on the
things
weekend.
They expected them to do. And they're all very exceptional. And in the case of the barbecuing, Weber does these studies that finds that women do all the work. They invite the people. They plan the menu. They shop for all the, you know, potato salad and the, you know, the things that, that they're going to serve. And that they themselves, with the convenience of gas grills, are the majority of the grillers. And, of course, the majority of the cleaners of the grill. So when we associate men with barbecuing, which the ads still do, you know, I've got the barbecue sauce in my back pocket and I know the good stuff and all those kinds of, you know, machismo kind of assertions. But the reality of who's barbecuing and who's making the decisions about barbecuing are almost entirely women.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Catherine J. Parkin. She teaches history at Monmouth University. And we're talking about her book. It's a really interesting read because it's both entertaining and yet really, really serious. Food is Love, Advertising and Gender Roles in Modern America. Catherine, the entire time I'm reading this book and actually reading your other book about women in driving and advertising, you know, you keep thinking about society trying to change gender role stereotypes and stuff like that. It just sort of seems like there was an entire group of people, like these advertisers and the people writing it, who are just, I mean, what are they doing? I mean, are they just so invested in the old gender role stereotypes that that's what they keep selling? I mean, and did the advertising work?
Well, there's an adage that half of the dollars spent on advertising are wasted. They just don't know which half.
Jesus.
And so I think that is a longstanding, you know, suspicion about whether advertising is really effective. In car advertising, for example, the assertion is it's not that it works, but you have to be in it. So, you know, if your company doesn't do it, then you're not in the mix of what people are thinking about. But advertising doesn't tip you toward one product, you know, one brand or another. In the case of food advertising, I think there's been such a proliferation of products, you know, the number of items available in a supermarket, you know, doubles and quadruples, and you know it feels kind of infinite now, all the different kinds of ketchup you could get, or you know, ketchup's been surpassed by salsa, so all the different salsas, that the ways in which we shop are so much denser in the sense of having so many more choices. I think the use of advertising is important, but I think they don't know how to reach people. If we're not watching the same TV shows, if we're not listening to the same radio station, if we're not doing things together, how do you target your advertising to consumers in a way that will get them? Historically, what they've believed is that the only people shopping that they can shape are the women. And so they've historically used women's magazines and more recently kind of women's media. And in those forums, I think they were trying to advance a very narrow sense that this was women's work. And, you know, why did they do that? Well, they believed and they found in their research that busy women need shortcuts. So they didn't necessarily want women to be at home homemakers. They wanted them to be busy. They found that in one study that they spent 20% more on groceries. because maybe they bought the prepackaged this or the frozen X to, you know, to serve alongside. And so there was profit to be made in the women being busy with outside employment or with employment generally. But the idea that women were comparably busy to men in their professional lives did not translate into them sharing that work as an ideology. And here, I think this is where some people argue that the advertisers were just reflecting what people were doing, that women were largely responsible for cooking and shopping and so on, and that this really wasn't something men were expected to do. I just don't think that's true. I think their research, and this is why being in the archives was so great, because you could see them finding that men were shopping, that men were cooking, and yet the...
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Catherine J. Parkin. She teaches history at Monmouth University, and we're continuing our conversation about her book, Food is Love, Advertising and Gender Roles in Modern America. Catherine, the whole thing about this, you know, people may say, it's just magazine advertisements, but I can remember as a kid sitting there with Life magazine and Look magazine and seeing these ads. That whole thing just filters in. I mean, it just becomes part of the way that you think life is.
Absolutely. And television builds on that, and radio as well. You know, there were Bill Cosby did Jell-O ads for a long time.
Ooh.
And the idea that girls should show up at the new boy's house with Jell-O to win him over. You know, they're socializing girls very young to the expectation that they be finding foods that boys like so that the boys will like them, that they have to provide and be demonstrating that they know that they're the ones who are going to be cooking and that it's their responsibility to please boys and then men.
Well, in your book, you also mentioned the Wonder Bread ads of 1967, which,
yes.
Okay, no offense, Catherine, but when I read about it, I go, come on. And then I did a web search and looked at the whole series, and my jaw dropped. They were actually suggesting that you could snare a man. And they use terms like date bait and boy trap. These were used in 17 magazine because of Wonder Bread.
What a feline way to show you care.
I know, again, we're laughing at it, but it's actually sort of, it is screwed up.
It's really screwed up. And, you know, were they targeting boys to cook at all, to shop at all,
right,
to be interested in brands? You know, in general, I did look at magazines targeted to boys and to men. I looked at Playboy. I looked at, you know, Hot Rod magazine, or, you know, just trying to understand, like, making sure that, because I wasn't reading those, you know, what were boys and men seeing? And they're not. I mean, the idea that the target audience for 17 magazine is about 13. So they're really going for young girls and trying to persuade them that they should care what brand food they're buying and creating a rationale that they should be doing it to please men.
There's so many other interesting topics that you bring out in this book, and I want to mention one of them. Most, if not all, of these ads that we're talking about are targeting white women.
Yeah.
What about ads targeting communities of people of color, black communities, Latino, Hispanic communities, Asian communities? Did that exist at all?
It really didn't. And, you know, I was trying to find evidence, you know, what were the advertisers thinking? What were the researchers telling them? And to the extent that they did learn that, for example, African-Americans were incredibly brand loyal.
Right.
They're facing discrimination in public settings. So they're spending more of their money to socialize at home, have parties at home and so on. So Planters Peanuts, for example, knows that there are loyal customers of their products. And yet, instead of saying, here are ads to try to encourage that or kind of, I think, reward that by advertising in black publications, they're instead taking that for granted. And they're worried, they claim, that if they advertise their products with African Americans, that they will be associating their foods with, quote unquote, quote, being black foods, that whites will then reject the very foods that African Americans are loyal to. So why did they care that African Americans were brand loyal to cornflakes? They never featured them in mainstream advertising, they didn't need to cater to them. They were worried if they suggested cornflakes instead of, I just read, are being eaten by the Queen of England. Why would they?
You're a fount of information that I never knew.
Well, it's following the royal wedding. You can't help but pick up these
she
details.
She eats cornflakes.
But I think the idea that African Americans or any other group had loyalties did not help them to get advertising dollars. And that's really devastating because that's what all of these publications, media, radio, TV, they depend on advertising dollars. And the fact that the food advertisers don't ever cater to them, I think is damaging. And I think it's also damaging in terms of showing everyday people. The studies of the inclusion of African Americans in everyday advertising continue to be incredibly low. They started studying it in the 1960s, and the rates really don't change. And so the idea, if you look at food advertising, you think, well, I've seen ads with Black people in them, and they tend to be either for Kraft products, who were sued, the company was sued to ensure that they were doing a better job of inclusion, and Campbell's Soup. But it's generally products that are so successful that they can kind of ride out this association potentially being made. Other products are unwilling to do it. And that comes back to your question about who's making these decisions. It is almost exclusively white executives in these advertising decisions. It's a very white profession. I found a statistic that there were more African-American brain surgeons than advertising executives.
Wow.
So it gives you some sense of how completely, they are focused on a white consumer. And I think it's damaging to the culture to not see these as all kind of shared foods and shared products. And, it contributes, I think, to a sense of it being a racially divided thing with a focus as only consumers being white.
So, and this is where your book gets really interesting, too, because besides the sexism and the sexual stereotyping, there's a whole racial issue here that, and I can remember this, the marketing of Chinese food, La Choy and Chongqing products, for instance.
Yeah.
You bring that up. That's a really fascinating story about how they had to be really careful to make sure that people, they had to assuage people's fears that the food was unclean because of people's racial stereotyping of Asian cultures.
Absolutely. And the same was true of Mexican foods as well, that the difficulty of trying to Americanize those products and make them familiar was a real challenge. You know, I think now they say there's, no towns of a certain population that don't have a Chinese restaurant. I mean, it's become such a pervasive part of the culture. But how do you get to that point? Partly it's through these companies introducing their canned and frozen products. To introduce people to them, and they do it in some pretty ugly, not just in the stereotypes, but in their portrayals. Some of them I think are more, I would consider them more benign of showing chopsticks or using characters from the Chinese language or something like that, but some of them are less.
They're horrible. And I grew up with those, and I remember they were all over television too. I mean, they weren't just in TV magazines. There's so many interesting sort of byways in this book. One of them is about cereal. Cereal is one of the problems with marketing cereals is that it was too easy. You just basically opened a box and poured it in a bowl. So they had to figure out a way to sort of guilt the woman into buying the cereal. And that was like as a laxative as one of the things, he wrote that the concerns were they needed Americans to eat cereal, not just for breakfast, but occasionally throughout the day, and not just children, but you need to eat cereal throughout your whole life. So they had to play up the health benefits of cereal. And then things get really weird because then you have Fleischmann's yeast. And the stuff that I learned in your books, I never knew that. Talk about that.
Fleischmann's yeast all products are really trying to find a way, as you suggested with the cereal, to kind of integrate themselves in every way. So they're not really content. I mean, cereal had to establish itself as a morning food because, you know, people used to eat heartier foods and
right.
during the day, that it was not a a light meal that you were trying to fortify yourself to go out and do what you were going to do. So companies like cereal companies and the yeast companies are looking for ways to get people to use their products more often. And some of the ways they do that is working together. So they'll say, oh, you should mix this product with this other branded consumer product. So they're, and they tell the women that they're the ones being creative and individuals in making these concoctions. And the idea that their health benefits are palpable. The cereal, one of them, you know, suggests that you would have pep appeal. So they're blurring this line between sexuality and health. They're trying to understand ways in which they can suggest that they will have beauty. The Fleischmann's yeast promises that will improve your complexion. You know, all these kinds of things that they're able to assert because no one really calls them on it.
Well, the Fleischmann's yeast thing is people used to use yeast for baking and
yes.
people weren't baking enough. So they decided to market it as a laxative and they were encouraging people to just take several chunks of Fleischmann's yeast every day and
yes.
just chew on it.
They're really more overt about on digestive problems than we might imagine on a whole host of products. Yes.
Oh my God! I mean, and again, there's so much fascinating information here. We're speaking of race again. I was fascinated tracking you know, the icons of certain Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben, and the cream of wheat cook, who I never knew the name of. His name ends up being Rastus.
Right.
In the case of the cream of wheat in the Aunt Jemima, the early years of those advertising icons were horribly racist. I mean, there's got to even be a stronger word than racism. It was basically white supremacy. I mean, it was the you know, the good old days of antebellum South, and this is the product's going to bring that home. Oh my God!
There's a wonderful book called Slave in a Box. And the scholar M.M. Manring is looking at how, exactly as you said, the kind of narrative story of where Aunt Jemima came from, the idea that she was a real person, which she wasn't, but the idea that she would effectively, by buying her products, meaning Aunt Jemima products, that white women could afford to have help in the kitchen. And increasingly over the 20th century, that went from being maybe possible in the middle class to only possible to the wealthiest. So the idea that her pancakes and she would provide the syrup and so on. And so the idea that white women would have help with these convenience foods is completely being told through this racial narrative that black people were going to be subservient to them in these products. And African Americans and others protested this, particularly starting in the 1960s, although for much longer than that. But those were some of the more visible protestations. And the company found that they didn't have to change. Their research showed African Americans were, in fact, buying Aunt Jemima products.
Oh, man.
And that they're... Even when they were making comparable products under a different name, people still liked the Aunt Jemima brand. They liked that story. And I think it's some of the, as you said, some of the most despicable kind of advertising that you see. I guess the thing that's surprising is the extent to which Aunt Jemima still kind of continues, whereas the Rastus character, you know, it has been more sidelined in there.
We're completely out of time. And again, we've only scratched the surface of this book. This was a really fascinating read. My returning guest tonight is Catherine J. Parkin. She teaches history at Monmouth University, and we've been talking about her book, Food is Love: Advertising and Gender Roles in Modern America. There's an awful lot in this book, and including the ads, but also do a web search like I did, and you'll find even more. Catherine, as always, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.